Mr. Hughes, the Vice President of Technical Affairs for the Electricity Consumers Resource Council. Before you hear from him, I will make a very brief announcement that I have received comments that, first of all, I'm not being heard very well, and second, that our speakers are not being heard very well. Get as close as you can to the microphone, Mr. Hughes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the members of the Electricity Consumers Resource Council, I want to thank the Commission for giving me the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. ELCON is a national association of large industrial consumers of electricity. We have a unique perspective on the issues addressed in this hearing. Our members operate major manufacturing facilities in all ISOs and RTOs and in all regions of the country not served by an ISO or RTO. They also operate such facilities throughout the world and have firsthand experience with electric restructuring efforts in a global context. And I want to add that we have many members who operate facilities in PJM and MISO, and especially Pennsylvania. Our membership overlaps with the membership of the PJM-ICC, the group that is capably represented by Bob Weishar, who spoke just before me. The purpose of my testimony is to challenge the assertion by many defenders of the organized markets that these markets that are administered by ISOs and RTOs are competitive, you know, that they are working examples of competitive markets, such as the markets that my members operate in on a day-by-day basis. Why is this important? I'm focusing on this attribute of competitive because it has become a ruse for countering the growing opposition of consumers to organized markets. FERC, ISO management, and the generators of market power all banded together to paint the organized markets with this image of respectability. ELCON members know what competitive markets are, and the organized wholesale electric markets administered by ISOs and RTOs do not qualify. ELCON was perhaps the earliest national group to advocate increased competition in the electric utility industry, in part because our members operate in competitive global markets and appreciate the efficiencies of open competition compared with poorly regulated centralized markets. However, after roughly a decade of experience with restructuring, there are clear indications that the ISO and RTO markets are too costly, not truly competitive, and fail to deliver net consumer benefits. It is certainly our organization's desire for real competition in the electric industry in all markets. But real competition simply has not happened and may not happen given the practical realities of the industry's structure and asset ownership. Despite an attempt to design a wholesale market structure consistent with economic theory and capable of supporting real competition, the design that was actually implemented and urged upon the industry by the FERC was shortchanged, creating the need for frequent ad hoc regulatory intervention that continues to this day and will likely continue as long as they rely on these market structures. ELCON has not been silent about our concerns with the organized markets. Since the first day two markets were launched, and these are the markets with an LMP framework, we have repeatedly urged the FERC or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to acknowledge that this market design is not working for the benefit of end users as required by the Federal Power Act. We urged to first to demonstrate that one ISO or RTO can work for the benefit of consumers before they try to impose that market design on other ISOs and RTOs in the country. They refused to do so. We urged them to initiate an inquiry into whether today's RTO platform with locational pricing can be made a viable market model for real wholesale competition. They have not done so. We asked them to acknowledge the magnitude of the problem and recognize that simple technical fixes or regulatory intervention, such as been ongoing now for almost 10 years, will not correct the inherent problems, and they have not done so. And we asked them to acknowledge that if real competitive markets cannot be achieved, then the public policy debate should shift to what form of regulation is appropriate to deal with the unique challenges of the electric industry and to states such as Pennsylvania. FERC, of course, has ignored the recommendation, and it's clear that they are unconcerned about the economic impact on consumers and the economy of the flawed market design under their control. I would also note that Elkhorn has opposed the use of modal or LMP pricing since it was first introduced in the infamous California restructuring proceeding in 1994. Our argument was and remains, whatever the theoretical merits of the construct, it is too complex and opaque to be faithfully implemented in an adversarial environment. A decentralized bilateral framework might have been more successful market design, you know, for the restructured industry. But in the California, you know, deliberations, that structure was abandoned, and it was suitably abandoned, or, you know, similarly abandoned by the FERC. The fundamental objective of competition and the creation of ISOs and RTOs from the very beginning was to deliver net benefits to end-use consumers. I think the defenders of organized markets bear the burden of demonstrating real evidence that competitive power markets have provided consumer benefits. While one benefit was supposed to be lower long-term prices compared with regulated rates, we also reasonably expected to see other benefits such as technological innovations, improved customer service, or the so-called killer products that are routinely delivered in truly competitive markets. But no such demonstration has been forthcoming because the competitive environment that would have brought them about is not there. Real competition has not been realized, and if it had, it should be self-evident. It is in all other markets that are competitive. Restructuring has replaced a state regulatory regime that had at least some end-user focus and rates based on average cost, you know, with a costly ISO-RTO federal regulatory regime that has no end-user focus and rates based on the highest accepted bid, which need not be based on marginal cost. A reasonable expectation would have been that competitive markets would deliver benefits to end-users vis-a-vis regulated markets. The premium prices paid by consumers in organized markets, and I note the graphs that my predecessors on this panel had in their testimony, these prices cannot be explained based on any greater value provided by improved service quality, customer focus, innovation, reliability, or any other tangible factor that we would have expected from a truly competitive market. And we didn't expect one of those, or maybe two of those, we expected all of those. The results of customer satisfaction surveys of large end users by a nationally recognized survey firm vividly show that the failure to achieve some of these expectations has significantly changed the way that large consumers viewed restructuring. Why am I raising this? Because some of these issues tend to be at the retail level. Large industrial customers are directly connected to the wholesale grid, meaning the transmission system. And they often have long-standing relationships with the local utility on how the interconnection, the substation and the transmission lines in that area, you know, are managed for the reliability and power quality needs of the manufacturing facility. Those issues have sort of fallen in a regulatory gap as a result of restructuring. And so some might see these as being a retail issue, others might see these as a FERC or wholesale issue. From the industrial perspective, in the, you know, ISO and RTO footprints, many of these concerns are no longer being addressed. Since 1998, the results of the survey I mentioned, the customer service scores in regulated states are consistently higher than those in restructured states for every factor measured in the service. And I draw your attention to tables 1 through 4 in the back of my written testimony. For purposes of right now, I think it is a summary would be to say that the overall satisfaction score for regulated states was 76%. For restructured state, it was 57%, or less than 19% of the regulated state. Those numbers are quite robust, and as the time series data on one of the tables shows, that trend has been diverging since the beginning of the restructuring era, meaning things are just getting worse. This sending price signals based on marginal cost, you know, which is really one of the economic cornerstones of restructuring the electric industry and you know, the fundamental principle behind so-called LMP pricing, is really meaningless if both the supply and demand sides of the market will not or cannot respond to those signals. LMP abandons rate-based average cost pricing and accepts prices based on marginal costs as determined by a single price clearing auction. And much is made of the need to send actual price signals to promote economic efficiency, and there probably isn't an economist on the planet that won't say that the best price signals are always marginal prices. And this is often the main excuse for preserving the regime of LMPs instead of returning the rates based on average costs. Yet there is no meaningful evidence the price signals are eliciting the expected response from the market. Real competitive markets respond quickly to the type of price increases experienced in the organized market. And I would command your attention to the changes in automobile usage that American, you know, drivers have experienced this year as the world oil prices have whipsawed and found their way into the gasoline prices. And what comes up comes down in response to the prices. We see no such thing in the power industry as a result of LMP pricing. And one of the and since we've seen none of this, the market can hardly be characterized as, you know, exhibiting any kind of competitive behavior. More importantly, there has been little market entry to eliminate transmission congestion or the entry of new baseload generation that targets the wide price spread between the marginal units that burn natural gas or other higher fuels at the margin of the LMP stack and the baseloaded coal and nuclear units. This issue has been alluded to earlier by Vice Chairman Christie and some of the other speakers, where under the auction regime of PJM and MISO, you've got the higher price fuels clearing the market and all generators basically receiving that price in the hour in which that price clears. And below that are the resource base of the region, which are the much lower cost baseloaded units. That spread, which can be called the intramarginal spread, in a competitive market would be the target of competitors. You know, that's what competitors look for in real competitive markets. They go after that. If they don't go after that, the phrase that's often used is, you're leaving money on the table. And there has been no evidence whatsoever in any of the ISO or RTO markets in the United States that there's any sufficient entry into the market of new players, old players from outside of a regional market going into a regional market where they've never been before, going after that spread, either by trying to reduce transmission congestion, you know, or by building generators that have lower costs than natural gas fired generators, that would, you know, allow them to go after the profits from that spread. And that is a serious shortcoming of the organized markets right now. And we see no way of really restoring that type of competitive, or even creating that kind of competitive behavior, absent some very fundamental changes in the capital structure of these companies, meaning divestiture of transmission from generation, and other things which are really kind of non-starters in the type of country that we have and our type of government structure. So this lack of entry contradicts claims of a competitive market, and that would and I think is more evidence of a real market failure than an example of competitive behavior. There also seems to be a tendency that if a problem cannot be fixed, then it does not exist. And I think the ownership issue in the electric industry is one such problem that FERC pretends doesn't exist. To its credit, at least former commissions have tried to resolve it. Order 888 is most noteworthy in trying to separate the transmission from the generation, but it fell far short of what it is really needed. And absent changes to that, which might even, you know, take some serious lawmaking by our Congress, we see the potential for creating competition in this market, you know, almost nil. And that is reinforced by the consequences of restructuring in foreign countries, Europe in particular, where the same set of ownership structures exists that prevent the formation of competition. I thank you for the opportunity to speak for you this afternoon, and I look forward to your questions.
An excellent job on producing this testimony. On page 5, you hit on an issue about the lack of new baseload generation being added within the PJM grid. And I share that concern. As I understand it, we may have only added over the past 10 years 300 or 400 megawatts out of almost 10,000 megawatts of a baseload power plant. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes.
Okay. So most of it's been natural gas and wind fire generation. And I think we've already discussed that with natural gas, the problem is the single market clearing price that just exasperates the pricing mechanism. And the issue I got with the wind, and I think you really hit it, the issue here head on, is wind is it's an excellent renewable resource product. But the reality is that wind only blows so often, and so the availability of these units is not anywhere near what a coal-fired plant or a gas-fired plant would be. And I guess the point or comment I'd just like to make here is with wind projects, they're heavily subsidized. They receive a production tax credit from the federal government, generally 1.9 cents a kilowatt hour. They receive REC credits under Pennsylvania's program. And I think I'm just concerned that people are drawing conclusions that the RTOs are working just wonderful because we have about 300 megawatts of wind projects. I just don't think one can draw that conclusion that the wind projects coming online is a reason why the RTO structure is working just perfectly. Do you have any comment on that?
I don't disagree with anything that you said. I think wind in particular, but also just renewable energy in general, renewable resources, are being driven, you know, by a large number of public policy drivers throughout the country. And it's not only in Washington, you know, by efforts by Congress and also the Department of Energy to advocate more the development of these technologies, you know, as a hedge for, you know, future environmental laws and other factors, high natural gas prices, for example. But I think the most powerful driver is probably resource portfolio standards that states have been implementing. And it's the rare state now that doesn't have one. States that had small ones have now increased them. And so it's hard to isolate from the statistics of on the development of wind capacity, you know, what's contributing to what. But you know, my own knowledge of you know, of the wind industry is that it has a very low coincidence of being on peak, so it doesn't get that much exposure to the you know, to the highest prices, and which is where the most powerful price signal, to the extent that it does exist, would be.
On page 10, you hit one of the issues that I'm very attuned to, and that's the need for long-term contracts in order to support the development of new capital-intensive facilities. I think that's a real lacking product in Pennsylvania right now. I think we have a lot of waste coal-fired generation at very attractive prices, but they need long-term contracts to pay for the billions of dollars of investment. And one of the concerns I have here is that when I started in this business back in the 80s, we would have reserve margins of around 25%. When we started deregulation, we were down around 20%. And now we're in the neighborhood of 14 to 15%. Now, I think it's great that we have much higher efficient running units, and that's a good thing as a result of deregulation. But I have a little concern about the razor-thin margins we have and what that might mean moving forward. I don't know if you have any concern about that as well.
We do. Cost of service regulation, where you have investments put in a rate base, that is an implicit form of a long-term contract. And that's what justifies rates based on average cost, because you've got that capital cost and rate base, and over the life of this product, customers are obligated to make the utility whole by paying rates that essentially amortize the average the cost of that unit over time, and therefore they get the average rate based on average cost. It was our desire in attempting to introduce competition to the industry that a robust bilateral forward contract type market would be created. This was debated in major states that tried to unilaterally institute restructuring, such as California and Texas, and for a variety of reasons, the nodal pricing won and the whole bilateral contract type of issue lost. And I think we regret that outcome. I think competition did not get its fair chance, and that having a much more of a contract-based market to us forms the basis for financing generation, which clearly isn't there right now.
I would agree with that comment. And going to page 11, your comment regarding the repeal of PURPA. PURPA was one of the vehicles that allowed long-term contracts to support the capital financing of some very beneficial solid fuel-fired facilities. In fact, before we had deregulation in 1996, our PURPA program in Pennsylvania, we added over 2,000 megawatts of waste coal, industrial cogeneration, hydroelectric, landfill gas, and we did it by simply having the ability to offer a long-term contract. And I can tell you that as a person who's intimately involved with the program, that having that opportunity to offer that contract, we had to fight away with developers. There were just thousands and thousands of projects that wanted to come forward. And I'd like to hear your comments from the industrial customer perspective. If they're going to start taking control of their future energy rates and the inability to get a long-term contract, perhaps, to do a cogeneration plant, how that might be affecting some of the industrial's business decisions.
Well, for all practical purposes, in states that are served by ISOs and RTOs, that section of PURPA Title II, has been repealed. And Congress allowed FERC to implement those that type of provision, and it gets back to the beginning premise of my oral remarks, was that it was a misuse of the word competitive. And FERC is saying everything out there is competitive, so therefore we don't need PURPA anymore. And that's going to be a very debilitating factor for the economics of this country going forward in terms of trying to meet the requirements of any kind of carbon standard. And because cogeneration, and which relied on PURPA to get around the opposition to on-site generation that it inevitably comes from the utilities and ISOs and RTOs, is going to be essential. We're going to have to maximize our energy efficiency utilization with combined heat and power types of applications. And this is something else that's got thrown away, the proverbial baby with the bathwater, that by having these flawed market structures in PJM and other ISOs.
One final question. On page 8, you talk a little bit about what the industrial rates are in a regulated structure in Indiana, Kentucky, and across the river where the rates are deregulated. Again, we see a situation where the rates are, it looks like they're double what they were compared to regulation. But in the regulated states, it appears that the numbers have only gone up maybe 10 or 20% over the past, say, 8 years. Can you just talk about that a little bit to sort of make sure I understand that correctly?
Well, these are the same examples that Bob Weischer mentioned early on. And the we have national markets, I could even say almost international markets, you know, for basic fuels. And so the fuel prices that are used by generators and inside ISOs and RTOs and outside are the same, so that the prices are going to go up everywhere, and they have been going up. The problem is that if you've got a rate structure in which you make prices based on the marginal unit in a single price auction, you become exposed, to the pricing volatility and the price increases of the most expensive fuels. And so having rate-based generation in regulated states based on average cost pricing, those rates are the result of policies that better hedge fuel prices than what happens in the ISO RTO markets, where the ability for where the prices only reflect the marginal fuel.
Thank you.
Commissioner Paulson.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for joining us today. You mentioned in your testimony about some of the current inefficiencies in the marketplace. And as you know, we just passed Act 129 here in Pennsylvania that would bring new tools to industry with demand response and conservation. But we're seeing deployment of smart metering here in Pennsylvania. Commissioner Wellinghoff at the FERC level is talking about microgrid technology coming to the states. One of the key points that staunch proponent of nuclear power, and you look at the efficiency gains and how those plants have been operated since they came out of the rate base into this capital marketplace that we're in now. Those efficiency gains, we look back to the 70s and 80s when those plants had cost overruns in some cases the billions. Those plants now are operating at efficiency gains of 90 to 96%. We also, my colleague mentioned the build-out of renewables here in Pennsylvania, and we also national policy on plug-in hybrids. So, I would think it's fair to say we have seen new technology roll out in the marketplace. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I mean, there's a lot of talk about that, but I'm not sure there's anything that's significantly affecting the marketplace that most consumers would experience. The issue of the efficiency or higher availability of the nuclear units wouldn't have made any difference whether that was done under restructuring or under regulation. It happened because the utility, the owner, was allowed to keep all the benefits. Those benefits, as nice as they are, I mean, the power industry in this country has something of a checkered, history. Yes, those happen, I can't deny it, but, nobody other than the owners of those units are benefiting from those efficiency gains, because those are the baseload units. The only way that customers and users can benefit from those efficiency gains, if those units are setting prices in any hour, and those efficiency gains result in the fact that the bid prices would be lower. As far as smart meters and all that other sort of stuff, that is still at the talk stage, and I really question whether or not that is the way to go as a matter of good public policy, because most customers, especially small customers, are not going to want to get thrown into the spot market, and big customers don't like being thrown in the spot market unless they have their eyes wide open and accountants and lawyers let them. They'll want to hedge that type of price exposure, you know, with contracts to give them a fixed price. So I think an important policy decision for regulators in the future, when they look at the issue of smart grid and advanced metering and so on, is with the intent of sending these price signals, you know, to all consumers, is will the consumers want those price signals, or will they, and if they are, you know, are forced to have the meter, will they then go out and sign a contract with somebody that gives them a fixed price, so the meter becomes absolutely useless? And some of the prices that we've seen, or the cost estimate that we've seen for implementing some of this stuff, especially going into a period of time when we expect some, you know, a very serious economic downturn, I'm not sure we want to, you know, kind of go that way right now, and let's think about it. But just to get to your question, no, we have not seen any of that type of innovation out there, you know, that is worth bragging about.
Okay. A follow-up, we talked about what's on the horizon with carbon legislation in Washington, and as you know, Pennsylvania, large coal producer. A lot of our base load is generated by coal-fired plants along with nuclear power. Your thoughts on the impact, and I know it's a little off the agenda today, but your thoughts on what should carbon legislation look like so we don't put an undue burden on some of our power producers here in the state that create jobs?
Kind of put on the spot with another man in our office who does this on a day-to-day basis. Clearly, the cap and trade structure is going to be the first proposal out of the box if the issue comes up in a new Congress. And I add that qualification because, again, as the results on Tuesday indicated, the economy and the economic situation in this country is getting, you know, real attention and deservedly so. And by the way, you know, if the economic forecasts are correct and we do go into a recession, you know, some are saying worse than the ones in the early 80s that I can remember very vividly, energy consumption is going to go down, and so we're going to be able to buy time because carbon emissions are going to be reduced as a result. And so I think, you know, and I would hope that that fact of life will get factored into the deliberations of Washington, because they're going to have their hands full for a lot of reasons.
I want to thank you. Very insightful, and appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Pittson-Grohe.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. Quick question. I wasn't clear on the number of large industrial consumers that you represent that are located in Pennsylvania.
That's correct.
Do you know how many of them?
I mean, how many? I really don't know.
Because you did mention that some of those...
I'll throw a number out. Probably, you know, and I would say more than a dozen companies and number of facilities is really a tough one. But
some of your...
I would say two dozen facilities, you know, but I may be wrong.
Your members, though, are also members of the PGM Industrial Coalition that we just heard from as well. Is that what you said?
Yes, there's overlap. There are companies that belong to Bob's group that have only facilities, you know, in Pennsylvania, would not be a natural member of our organization. I mean, the characteristic of an Elcon member is major facilities in multiple jurisdictions. When I first joined Elcon 20 years ago, all of our members had were based in the United States at corporate headquarters here. Now half of them are based overseas, Tokyo, Paris, you know, Italy, you know, Amsterdam. And they remain, I mean, we have, you know, major facilities in probably all of the 48 states, and probably Alaska, I know Alaska, I don't know about Hawaii, but as I said early on, you know, they have real experience in all of these ISOs and RTOs.
Would you be supportive of the alternate market design proposal that we heard from the PGM Industrial Coalition?
our membership debated the two models that were presented at FERC, one that was introduced to you today, and there's also a second one that's been championed by the American Forest and Paper Association. And they never really just spend a lot of time on them, looking at them. They rejected outright support for them right now. I guess they wanted to see more details. And they wanted to be part of a debate, where, there's some... The models get kind of get a good testing, get shaken, and, and so we're kind of we're on the fence right now. I think that's probably the fair answer. We're not likely to get involved in any proceeding in Pennsylvania that does it. Bob's group is going to be there, and we're going to support Bob's group, and I'll follow what's going on. If it ever goes to FERC, and FERC considers it as an alternative to the designs of all the ISOs and RTOs under its jurisdiction, we will become very active there, because then that impacts all our members. For a variety of reasons, there's Bob's group has their work cut out for them before you, and that's rightfully so. They've got a broader membership of companies from this state and who need their voice heard. Our membership, includes a lot of companies that aren't here that, don't want to be involved unless there's a chance that it would set a precedent nationwide or globally that they would be impacted.
One more quick question. On your tables on page 14, the customer service factor scores and surveys, do you know how many Pennsylvania manufacturing customers, hospitals, or universities were included in these numbers? Were they included, any Pennsylvania's customers included in the survey?
Yeah, I could probably find out, but I'll say this with confidence, a lot.
I know this firm and their coverage is pretty thorough. They strive for a statistical, mass in each state where they do their business, because that adds to the credibility of their product and the profit that they make from selling the service, to utilities as well as in some cases to commissions that need these numbers for benchmarking performance.
That would be helpful to have it if there were Pennsylvania companies. Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes, for coming. And I'm going to have to be a little bit of the cynical commissioner that I am. My question, with no disrespect to you, but if Elkhorn was one of the major advocates of deregulation in its early stages, and now that you believe it has gone wrong, why should I give you any attention at all at this point in time?
In other words, I think my response is this. Our members are results-oriented. Okay, they're not ideologues. And I want to emphasize that. And, we recognize the fact that we're a strong advocate of a market that never happened. Okay? And not that it was a... We do not advocate for a market that happened, but we didn't like the results of it. It's two different things. And I think my point of my testimony is that we wanted and we advocated a competitive market. We did not get a competitive market. The markets that are operated by the ISOs and RTOs in the United States are a form of regulation. They are not a form of competition. They are every bit as micromanaged and subject to all kinds of rate design practices, policies, and mechanisms of even a cost of service type of of state. I would argue they're even more complicated and lack the transparency of cost of service type regulation in regulated states. But it's the form of regulation that's out there, and it's a very flawed form of regulation that has resulted in the lack of construction, lack of new infrastructure, lack of investment in new transmission for the relief of congestion, no innovation, high prices, higher prices than elsewhere. So I don't think we've really changed anything. I think it's, the results did not materialize what we were advocating for.
The next piece of it would be, is could you speak to a perception that large industrial users nationwide were typically cross-subsidized by other rate cap classes? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I'm old enough to remember the situation in this country in the 70s and 80s when I first began working in the electric utility industry. I worked on a regulatory agency in Massachusetts for part of my life. I also worked for a utility in New York. And for the utility in New York, there was an agreement between the CEO of that utility and the governor that that utility would never go in for a rate case that, in which the percentage increase for residential customers was double digits. So they could go in with a 7, 8, 9% increase, rate increase for residential, but not 10, 11, 12, whatever the costs were. And the difference had to be made up in raising the rates, shifting those costs to industrials and commercial class, especially the commercial class. And, that is one of the reasons for, and by the way, back in those days, you had high oil prices when utilities were burning a lot of oil. They were phasing in the cost of nuclear plants. So there was a need to increase rates. And the whole cross-subsidization issue, was created in states where they had those tremendous cost pressures. And it didn't happen in all states. Not all states had the same experience with nuclear plants, or were exposed to oil prices when oil was being used. So, and Elcon as a organization for many years, part of our bread and butter type of advocacy was the elimination of cross-class subsidies.
So, in other words, Elcon today is perfectly supportive of paying its true cost for its rate class, and it does not support cross-subsidization by any other class. Thank you.
Chairman Cullen.
Mr. Hughes, would we be still hearing the same criticisms from you had we not deregulated the generation part of the bill? In other words, is electric competition the cause of these wholesale market problems, or would they exist with or without electric competition deregulation?
You're asking if there had not been the deregulation of generation?
Right. If we had never deregulated the generation part of the bill, would your criticism still be the same of the wholesale market? Or would we have these problems with the wholesale market pricing in any event?
It's hard to say because, again, the primary reason, or one of the primary reasons for deregulating generation was the whole stranded cost issue. And many states forced the divestiture of generation and deregulated the generators at the time for stranded cost purposes. And I don't think it had much to do with competition at all. If competition was really on their mind, they would have thought twice about how they divested those generators. And so what they ended up doing was shifting market power from one entity to another. And that is the one of the issues that we face today. Had the incumbent utilities kept the generation, we probably would have had to go into a regime like we have in transmission, functional separation. And I would argue functional separation and transmission does not work very well. Probably wouldn't have worked very well in generation. And so I think what our members are struggling with right now is there a recognition that, you know, trying to get workable competition in this industry may very well be impossible.
Well, I thank you for your testimony. I have been reading Elcon materials since the first time I served on this commission in the early 80s. Begun by John Anderson, I believe.
John Anderson was probably surfing right now in Hawaii. And we took a little mid-fall break
as part of a work engagement, a speaking engagement in that neck of the woods, and took a little vacation. So I appreciate your thoughts. We have a whole series of new papers coming out next couple of weeks that will deal with a lot of the important issues that will be on your plate in the next couple of years, mostly related to you know, climate change mitigation issues. And so I really want to thank you and your fellow commissioners for this set of hearings, and I encourage you to follow up on a lot of these issues and get a good debate going. You know, the manufacturing sector in this country is not dead, and I think if anything was learned by this credit debacle, you know, debacle of the finance community, is that our economy is going to depend an awful lot going forward on iron in the ground type of facilities that manufacture real products. And it is important that all segments of the economy that support a viable manufacturing segment, for our members, the energy, you know, segment is really important, be fair, workable, and least cost.
Thank you again for your insights, and I look forward to reading your forthcoming white papers.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, sir. Chairman and Commissioners, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Kenneth Rose, an independent consultant who has also worked with the Institute of Public Utilities at Michigan State University. As soon as we get over a few brief technical difficulties. Dr. Rose.
Thank you very much, Mr. Judge Co-Chairs, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioners, for having me. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you today. I haven't been to Pennsylvania or Harrisburg in a long time, so it was good to come back to a beautiful area, a beautiful part of your state. I guess am I responsible for this?
So would you bring the microphone closer to you?
Is that better?
Yes.
What I'll do is you have, or you should have, my prepared statement, and rather than reading that, what I'll do is just summarize what's there and attempt to go through those graphs that are in there. And I apologize that the first version I sent, I didn't realize that those graphs wouldn't print very well, so I sent another version, and now there may be some the text is exactly the same. It's just hopefully the graphs will print out a little bit better in that second version. So I apologize for that. I didn't realize it myself until I tried to print it out after I had filed it with the commission. Given the short amount of time here, what I'd like to do is just really talk about three different topics that I think are interconnected and that I think are very important and kind of lead to other kinds of things that perhaps you can talk about in the Q&A and further in other cases as well. But first of all, what I'd like to talk about is the fuel cost, electricity price connection. You saw some testimony on that already, and obviously that's an important issue. Next, I'd like to talk about the need for some real market analysis, some kind of hard-headed economics, I think, that is needed in order to really tell just how well these markets are working. And then finally, to talk about how retail customers are affected by the wholesale market. In particular, this doesn't apply directly to most of Pennsylvania, since you still have price caps. But in those states now where the price caps have expired, we can start to see what happens with that connection now between the wholesale market and the retail market. I realize this is focused on the wholesale market, but I think that obviously is very important. The other thing I'd like to just mention is, and just commend the commission too for holding this kind of a hearing. There aren't very many commissions that have done this kind of fact-finding and listening to different points of view on how the markets are doing, and that even includes some legislative bodies. I've testified in several different states, so I know there's a number of states that are taking a second look at the restructuring. Unfortunately, not very many public utility commissions, so I think the commission is to be commended for taking up the task of listening to different points of view on this issue. Turning to the fuel cost electricity price connection first, let me say first off that there's little doubt that there is a connection. But as already been pointed out by Commissioner Christie, there's a disproportionate impact of natural gas on the prices. And if you look at the graphs that I prepared for this, just look at figure one briefly, you'll see that you can see the substantial difference between what's going on with natural gas prices. This is looking in dollars per million BTU as compared to coal. Coal prices have been going up fairly substantially, but nothing like what we've seen for natural gas. I checked this morning, natural gas is running about $7, so it's lower, about $3 lower than what it was showing here from the EIA data. Also, this is cost data for utilities. It's a little different than looking at the spot market price for that you see for natural gas, so that accounts for some of the difference as well. If you put in, then, as we do, and as I did in figure two, you add in the PJM LFP, and these numbers are directly from the market monitor of PJM, and you plot that along with the price for natural gas, or the cost for natural gas, and the cost for coal, you can see it's very highly correlated with the price for natural gas, and in fact more so than it is for coal. Just looking overall, you can see that coal went up about 60%, a fairly sizable increase. Looking from 1999 to 2008, natural gas, though, has gone up by 285%. I mean, everybody's aware of that. If you heat your home with natural gas, you know, as I do, that what that means. And the LMP price, this is the weighted average, weighted by the load for the entire PJM region, went up 126, almost 127%. So it's a fairly sizable increase during that time period. And the thing I'd like to point out here is, again, as Commissioner Christie has already pointed out, natural gas is only about 7.7% of the generation, accounts for 7.7% of the generation on PJM, and coal and nuclear power account for about 90%. And that proportion has been consistent for about the last couple of years. Now, the usual explanation for that, when you point that out, is that natural gas is often on the margin. And so that bears a little bit more analysis to look at that a little bit deeper, and you find out that natural gas is not the fuel that's on the margin most hours in PJM, but it turns out that coal is the one that's the most common with, on 70% of the time it's coal that's on the margin, and that natural gas is on the margin 24% of the hours. I looked at this in a lot more detail, by the way, in a paper that is cited in my remarks, the prepared remarks, that was done for APPA last year, looking at that fuel price connection, and there's a little bit more analysis in there about what was on the margin and when, so I invite you to take a harder look at that. But what I'd like to point out here is not only is that there's this disproportional impact that natural gas appears to be having on the LMP price, but also I think for in terms of doing the analysis and drawing any kinds of conclusions from that kind, you really have to be very careful when looking at lines on a graph or the correlation coefficients or whatever you calculate to really draw any kind of conclusions about what is related to what. So I'd like to bring your attention then also to figure 3. And this also has the PJM locational marginal price. And you can see it's fairly correlated with another series here, which is, but it turns out that that's the Manufacturing Hourly Compensation Index of Sweden. And those appear to be highly correlated as well. I should say it was a little disconcerting. It didn't take me very long to find a series that obviously is not related to the LMP. You know, as an economist, I like to think the world is orderly and explainable and makes sense, and then you find out that maybe it's a little bit more random than we may think. But the point is not to say that the connection between natural gas or fuel costs and LMP is not there. The point is that it really says nothing at all to us about the performance of the market, the fact that they're moving up and down together. And I'm in complete agreement with Joe Bowring, who said in his testimony before you a couple weeks ago that the in a competitive market, when the input prices go up, the electricity prices go up as well. And that's absolutely true. I'll just add to that that in a monopoly, if or an oligopoly or some other kind of market structure, when the input prices go up, the prices for the final product will go up as well. So that, again, doesn't really tell you anything about the analysis. You have to have the more detailed analysis that tells you about just how well that market is performing. Now, this really leads to the second point I'd like to make to you today, is that this need for some real market analysis. And all the RTOs, as you probably know, all the RTOs that are approved by FERC are required to have a market monitor. And let me say, I think PJM has a good one. I personally like Joe Bowring. I think he does a good job. I'm going to pick on him a little bit here because I think this could be improved. But I'm a reader of his State of the Market report. Probably like you, I anxiously await it when it comes out. And I wish it was getting shorter instead of longer every year, but that's probably because we're adding so much to this. He's also adding things on the analysis. But many, like Mr. Bowring or Dr. Bowring, as well as many other of the market monitors, use concentration measures to look at what's going on within PJM, in particular the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, the Pivotal Supplier Index, and those are very useful tools that should be used, but you can't really draw any serious conclusions, again, about the performance. If you look at the way the Department of Justice examines mergers, for example, using HHI, they typically use that as a screening tool, not as the analysis of what might happen when they actually go to decide whether or not to approve a merger or not. And I don't think we should really be relying too heavily on that in the electric business as well, other than, again, just characterizing the general structure of the industry. The other thing that I think is a credit to Joe Bowring's analysis that he goes a little bit further than some of the other RTOs. I think this is why I think he does a reasonably good job. And includes in there a markup index. And I'm particularly talking about the markup index, not the markup calculation he does it. There's two different ways he does it in the State of the Market report. This is very similar to the Lerner index that named after Abel Lerner from back in the 1920s. And it's a pretty standard measure of how well the markets are performing. The problem with that is, while the prices are fairly easy to get that information, when you have to use, and there's a base for the calculation, the marginal cost. And the problem with the marginal cost is that it's very difficult to measure. It's not an easy number. You know, when we teach economics, we draw a marginal cost curve on the graph, and it looks relatively simple and easy to explain. Unfortunately, trying to actually measure it is a lot more difficult. But in particular, after several years of trying to draw out exactly how the market monitor and PJM calculates the marginal cost, I've become convinced that they're overstating it because of the methodology that they use. And if I could use high-tech visual aid, my hands, if the roll index, which ranges between, or the markup index ranges between 0 and 1, when the way you're calculating that, it's a percent of the price. So if the marginal cost is too high relative to what it actually is, then that means that markup number is going to be too small. And I think that's the reason why almost year after year and for most months, Joe Bowling's numbers are usually very, very small. And I suspect that's why some people, including the FERC commissioners, may be coming to the conclusion that everything is fine because they're not really looking at any great detail on how that number is actually being calculated. We need to have the data to be able to verify that. Now, I won't go so far as to say, you know, when you bring this up with the suppliers, they don't like the idea of this data being put out in the public because of fear that their competitors would be able to find that. But I think it's reasonable to say that the states, including Pennsylvania PUC, you have capable staff that would be able to do the analysis, ought to be able to have that. And you handle things like that in your proceedings all the time, where there's proprietary data that is not released to the public. And now, as you pointed, Mr. Chairman, pointed out right at the beginning, you don't have the authority to order this yourself, but FERC does. So what I suggest is that you work with FERC in trying to get this information and require it being made available to Pennsylvania PUC and other PUCs as well. And hopefully we'll be able to have some kind of a verification then of those numbers. And then finally, what I'd like to do is just talk about the connection then between the wholesale market, what's going on in the wholesale market, and then the retail customers and how it may affect Pennsylvania. It actually already has affected Pennsylvania in a couple areas, but obviously a lot more as the price caps start to come off. And I should say, I'm not doing it here, but I've watched those states where the price caps have come off and what's happening in those very closely, so that I think that tells us a lot more about what's going to happen to the retail prices. So sometimes the analysis of what's going on in the
minute, sir.
Don't always tell you everything, but basically what we've done is we've had a series of policy decisions that break down the various components of the generation price into various component parts. And every time we do that, we lose the scope economies that economists usually talk about, or the synergies of having one supplier provide all those services. This says nothing about market power or anything. It's just a function of the way that this is starting to develop. So I think that's adding costs that you can start to see now. And just as an example, I used New Jersey and their auction. And it's a very transparent process, and that's the only reason why I used New Jersey, where you can see the basic generation service or the BGS auction and compare that to the energy prices by zones within the New Jersey area. I'm not picking on New Jersey. Again, it's just a very a good example. So I invite you to take a look at that. You can see about half of those costs now that are being added on to customers just for the generation component are those non-energy components, that and those are capacity, ancillary services, all those other things. I listed them in my testimony. And every time we invent a new, like the RPM or anything else, it adds more costs into that system than what we didn't face before. My time is up, so I thank you for having me, and I look forward to your questions.
Vice Chairman Christie.
Let us first thank you, Dr. Rose, for coming today, and if we could give you an award, I think, for being the furthest traveling person coming here. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate the fact that we're being an independent consultant and just coming here, frankly, on your own nickel. Says a lot, and we very, very much appreciate it. I think you've just hit on, I think, one of the single most important issues that this commission should focus on, and that's to dig into the definition of marginal cost within the PJM structure. Because I've struggled with the definition of a competitive market being cost plus 10%. And so when we have times where there's the three pivotal supplier tests is applied, there's an monopoly situation, the generators are limited to cost plus 10%, which sounds infinitely reasonable. Where it is broken down for me is when I look at Pennsylvania being so heavy coal, so heavy nuke, with an extremely low running rate, and again, maybe I'll be generous here by saying it's 3 cents a kilowatt hour running rate, and they end up getting 7 cents a kilowatt hour rate. I don't know, I'm not going to use some of these fancy index names, but I'll use it a common sense index that there's a lot of margin being made here. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to take your suggestion and really to dig into that marginal cost and see how that's being defined to see if that is fair. The other issue that you pointed out, and I applaud you for this, when you look at in Pennsylvania when our caps come off, and look at the resultant rates that will result from retail marketing or from deregulation, there's two components as you have in your chart. There's one, the wholesale prices. And hopefully, moving forward, we'll find ways to make this RTO structure and the prices that result fair and favorable and balanced for everyone. And I do believe there's a way to do that to make everybody happy at the end of the day. But the other piece that you point out here, that's near and dear to my heart, is when we have the full requirements retail supply approach, it adds a lot of extra cost, as your charts are showing here. And I think there's a lot of risk premium that we're placing into the full requirements approach. When we ask suppliers to basically take on the responsibility of meeting a certain load, an unknown amount of load, at a fixed price in the future, I just think that is adding a bit of a risk premium. And we do our own analysis here. We look at the wholesale prices and then we say, okay, how much margin on top of that is being charged to the customers? And there's a significant margin being charged. And I think it's because of the point that you just point out here in the full requirements. And although maybe a penny a kilowatt hour doesn't sound like a lot, in Pennsylvania it's about $2.2 billion. So maybe you could just talk with me for a couple, about a minute on that one, if I'm on the right path here.
I agree. That's in addition to these direct costs. What I tried to do, let me just back up a little bit, what I tried to do is to look at it from the perspective of a new supplier in an area who owns no generation. And they have to go out and contract for or purchase or build generation, and then all the other requirements that they have in order to be a load-serving entity within PJM. And in addition to all those different costs, and I listed some of them here, the ancillary services and all that, there are those risks. And I've tried, and I didn't do it here, but in other cases, I'll send you some presentations I've done where I've tried to break down those different classes, those other different kinds of costs. And a couple, one of them in particular, I think is fairly sizable, is the mitigation risk, I'm sorry, the migration risk, that the customer may leave the system, leave them as a customer, because there's no requirement, of course, if they don't have the customer signed up for any long term. So this is particularly a problem if you've got a very large customer. So there's a risk premium in there that they try to gauge about, well, what's the risk that this customer may leave and we'll be stuck having to buy power that we have to then just turn around and sell at whatever is going on in the wholesale market at the spot market at that time. And I've actually had that verified when I've made this presentation several times, and people that are suppliers in states have said, yes, that's basically what we do. We look at those things. There's those costs that we can quantify, you know, things like ancillary services. You can get a pretty good gauge from the ancillary services market if you're operating a PJM or one of the other RTOs that have that. And then it's really pretty much a judgment call on trying to account for those added risks that are on top of that. So it's probably fairly sizable. I did make an attempt. I was doing some work in Illinois with the Illinois Attorney General. There was a client of mine at that time. And we were actually trying to figure out how to break that down. And the Illinois Commerce Commission staff also tried to break it down. I became convinced that we just couldn't really identify it item by item, and there's maybe a dozen or 15 or so of these items that you could at least, you know that they're there, but actually putting a number on those turns out to be extremely difficult. Some of them are easy, ancillary services, the others, but those risks are very difficult to quantify.
Thank you very much.
In fact, what happens is people kind of throw up their hands and say, well, whatever's left over are those risks. But we don't really know if that's reasonable or not.
Thank you.
Commissioner Paulson.
I'm going to defer to my colleague in the interest of brevity here.
Commissioner Pittsengrove.
Thank you for coming. Don't let us, the lack of questions. We have a lot of materials before us, and of course, as you know, we just got most of it yesterday, but we will be spending a lot of time on this in the coming weeks, and we appreciate you coming. Thank you.
Sure. I'm available, too, by email or call me or anything. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner Gardner.
My colleague, Commissioner Pissangrilli, stole my comments.
She's like that.
Yeah. I don't have any questions. I'm very appreciative of your testimony, and I can assure you that my office will be in touch.
Mr. Chairman.
I also want to thank you for coming, Doctor. We owe a debt of gratitude to you for your exemplary service at the National Regulatory Research Institute at Ohio State and for your continuing affiliation with the Institute for Public Utilities at Michigan State.
I'm in Williamsburg.
In Williamsburg.
We're having a meeting in Williamsburg next month in December, so I hope you're able to attend. That's a little advertisement that I slipped in.
I agree with you completely on the call for more transparency in the data. I'm reminded of World Outage Trust but Verify. And from practicing law, I know that competitors are learning about releasing proprietary information for fear it will get out and it will harm them in the market. We have confidentiality agreements and the like, which we try to deal with that problem. But at a minimum, I think your point is well taken that at least state commissions ought to have access to the same information that the market monitor does. And it strikes a chord with us, and I suspect all state regulators, when Mr. Hughes, I think rightly says that we've evolved into a situation where the grid, the independent service organization, the regional transmission organization, whatever it is, has become, in many respects, a substitute for state regulators. And we chafe at the fact that a great part of the bill is not under our control anymore, nor do we have, it would seem, any control over what gets built and by whom, which, of course, directly affects not only wholesale prices, but eventually the retail prices.
Right.
So I think we've got to do whatever it takes to get the information. I think we ought to be trusted with it, because if we aren't going to be trusted with it, who is going to be trusted with it in government? And I believe the people of Pennsylvania rely on us to do the verification here. So your point is exceedingly well taken, and it's good to listen to you again. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Willis.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, our next speaker will be Mr. David Chalone. He's the manager of Global Energy Services for Alcoa Incorporated. He's brought with him a PowerPoint demonstration.
Sir? Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and members of the Commission for the opportunity to testify today. My name is David Chalone. I work for Alcoa as a manager of Global Energy Services.
Mr. Chalone, would you just move that mic closer and tilt it up towards you?
How's this?
Much better. Thank you.
And I'm responsible for the procurement and management of natural gas and non-smelting electricity in North America. including the company's aluminum rolling mill in Lancaster. I'm honored to be before you today and among this company to have the opportunity to share my views on wholesale electricity markets. By now, you've already heard the technical, legal, and scholarly arguments on many aspects of how the wholesale electricity markets have been structured and operated over the past decade or so. You have heard that in many ways, the reality of retail electric deregulation competition has fallen far short of the vision that we had for this experiment when we embarked upon it in the 90s. However, rather than repeat what you've already heard, my purpose today is to focus on a perspective that is vital to the health of the economy of our Commonwealth and our country. I hope to provide a perspective that has been heard far too infrequently in discussions such as these. Specifically, I will focus my remarks on how the impact of rising energy prices, driven by a dysfunctional wholesale market, will affect our ability to continue manufacturing rolled aluminum products or make other manufactured goods in Pennsylvania. I will discuss how these defects are driving family-sustaining manufacturing jobs out of state and offshore. In so doing, I hope to add urgency to the several efforts aimed at correcting these defects. It's a simple fact that manufacturing jobs are the foundation of any strong economy. We are all familiar with the FIRE economy built on financial, insurance, and real estate enterprises, but as some of us are now learning anew, it is the making and shipping of tangible things that drive a vibrant economy from the bottom up. These are the jobs that enable a population to afford mortgages, to have health care, to educate their kids, to plan a retirement, and to support other businesses and worthy endeavors in their communities with purpose and dignity. As we've seen in other states, communities that do not have viable industrial ratepayers soon no longer have residential or commercial ratepayers. And as we've also seen in those communities, once these jobs are gone, they do not come back. For those unfamiliar with Alcoa, it might be helpful to share some background. There's no company on the planet with more experience in mining, refining, and smelting aluminum than Alcoa. Founded in 1888 by a group of investors and one of the world's two inventors of the commercial smelting process, Alcoa maintains its position on the leading edge of aluminum technology and sustainability. Alcoa serves the aerospace, automotive, packaging, building and construction, commercial transportation, and industrial markets, bringing design, engineering, production, and other capabilities of Alcoa's businesses to its customers. The company has 97,000 employees in 34 countries and has been named one of the top most sustainable corporations in the world at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. While our energy services group in Pittsburgh serves Alcoa's businesses globally, our North American focus extends to 45 major locations in 26 states and provinces. Alcoa is committed to sustainability, and we are a leader in climate change. Alcoa is a founding member of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, USCAP, an expanding alliance of major businesses and leading climate environmental groups. These groups have come together to call on federal government to enact legislation requiring significant reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. We also act on our commitments. Two of our most significant accomplishments, rooted in our culture of environmental stewardship, include reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 33% since 1990, and recognition for our energy efficiency programs. More specifically, at Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Alcoa produces aluminum sheet for a variety of markets including automotive, commercial, transportation, consumer electronics, and consumer goods such as cookware. We've been a member of our community since the 1940s and currently employ more than 850 people at our plant. A study released this spring put our total direct economic impact on Lancaster County at nearly $240 million. This is long, but all of it is to say that we believe Alcoa is a great corporate citizen and the kind of industrial you want in your community. Within the Commonwealth, Alcoa is proud to associate with 26 other similarly motivated members of the Industrial Energy Consumers of Pennsylvania, IECPA. Together, the members of IECPA provide over 43,000 of these family-sustaining jobs within the Commonwealth, with an estimated economic annual impact of over $12 billion. As you might guess, heating 32,000-pound aluminum ingots and then rolling them in a sheet or plate uses enormous amounts of energy. Our Lancaster plant is among the largest industrial users in Pennsylvania and spends more than $10 million annually purchasing electricity. However, several other members of IACMA use far more electricity. Together, IACMA members consume over 6.6 billion kilowatt hours of electricity per year. This puts us on the front line of any change in electricity price. To shift metaphors, we are the canary in the coal mine. Unlike some of my colleagues this afternoon, Alcoa has direct, first-hand experience with the havoc wrought by flawed market structures in both PJM and ERCOT. Our aluminum smelter in Frederick, Maryland closed in 2005 when Maryland's move to the PJM market was completed and we were no longer able to obtain long-term competitively priced power. Ultimately, this eliminated 700 great jobs and all the things within that community that went with them. Just a few weeks ago, Alcoa announced that we had been forced to curtail production at our Rockdale, Texas smelter and eliminate 820 jobs because of local power price and supply issues driven by the ERCOT market. Because of their energy-intensive nature, aluminum smelters are the first to feel the impact of rising energy costs. In other businesses, the results might not be as immediate, but it is just as real over the longer term. Earlier this year, Alcoa and Alcoa executive asked me for a long-term forecast of electricity prices for Lancaster. When we forecasted the prices resulting from our exposure to the post-rate cap PJM market, the best numbers we could produce painted an extremely challenging picture for the business, a 67% increase. As bad as this was, when we considered the large volatility in these prices and the limited ability to manage that volatility, the picture became worse still. We were looking at an annual average prices that could range from 44 to 113% of current prices. Most of our products are sold in the markets where pricing is very competitive and suppliers come from every part of the world. Passing along cost increases such as these will be difficult or even unlikely. More likely, our task will be to try to cut costs elsewhere. If we're not completely successful, our higher costs will make it more difficult to win new capital investment from Alcoa, which evaluates where to invest shareholder money based on the prospects for earning an acceptable return. We are competing with different businesses around the world, even within Alcoa, for capital investment. To put real perspective on the adverse impact of the PJM market design, the accompanying three charts compare the electricity rates of Lancaster to those of key competitors, including Alcoa's rolling mill in Davenport, Iowa. To produce these charts, we used our forecast for Lancaster, as well as the known tariff rates available to industrial customers from their host utilities. We also used a recent study by Carnegie Mellon to estimate the value of the LNP price inflator effect, that is, the gap between prices and cost. In order to preserve the confidentiality of certain rates, the comparisons are all expressed as a percentage of the rates paid by Lancaster. May I have the first chart, please? Chart 1 makes the comparison in 2008 based upon Lancaster's cap rates and shows that two competitors already have a significant advantage with respect to electricity costs. It is important to emphasize that these comparisons are made using the published tariff rates and that it is most likely that these competitors enjoy negotiated special contracts that afford them better rates and an even more decided competitive advantage than indicated by these charts. Chart 2 advances the clock to 2010, when Lancaster's prices will be determined by the operation of the PJM market, and its competitors will still be subject to fully regulated rates. While the regulated rates have been increased based upon what we know about present and likely filings in those jurisdictions, the Lancaster rates increase faster. Suddenly, Lancaster is fighting a large competitive disadvantage relative to all the competitors shown. The situation is very troubling. Chart 3 repeats the comparison of Chart 2. However, it isolates the estimated value of the LNP price inflator. In this view, we clearly see that this cost disadvantage being borne by Lancaster is almost entirely attributable to the market design. In other words, it's the market design that is threatening the future of the Lancaster mill. This is important. This is the most important concept in my testimony, so I'll repeat it. The market market design is threatening the future of the Lancaster Mill. This threat is for the short-term benefit of the power generators, but it is to their long-term detriment. Think of it this way. Once the rails were gone due to unsustainable harvest, the railing industry collapsed. The rest of my testimony will deal with qualifying the threat of market design to Pennsylvania. We can also estimate the adverse impact that the PJM market design is about to have in Pennsylvania by applying a study being developed at Penn State and a study performed this past summer by the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. The Penn State study is designed to estimate the resulting macroeconomic impacts of changes in the electricity rates on jobs, population, gross state product, etc., while the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission study attempted to estimate the various electricity rates by customer class following the expiration of Pennsylvania's rate caps. Because exposure to the uncapped market is essentially the same as exposure to the PJM market design, we can use the Pennsylvania PUC results as inputs into the Penn State model to estimate the impact of exposure to the PJM market design. Using this approach, we estimate that the PJM market design will cost the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania between $34,400 and $64,500 private, non-farm jobs by 2015. Further, of these jobs lost, roughly 11,500 to 21,500 will be the high-paying manufacturing jobs. Of course, these job losses would occur in a corresponding environment of shrinking population, declining gross product, and other measures of declining economic health. In discussing this application of their model, the authors noted that further study could more than likely show that the model is nonlinear. In other words, with the increases in electricity costs projected by the Pennsylvania PUC, a threshold condition could be reached that would aggravate the adverse impacts estimated by the present simple algorithms. This means that we could start a spiral which would be difficult to stop. Manufacturing companies compete globally, and we need power prices that are affordable, sustainable, and predictable. Large capital projects require years to pay out their full return. In order to risk the investment, businesses need to trust that the rules will not undergo significant change without warning and that the cost is commensurate with the energy service received. Alcoa, like other industrials, has demanding shareholders and even more demanding customers. We compete in a global market that has decided to not level. We have competitors who are not forced to bear many of the costs that we pay every day. Ultimately, however, the reality is quite simple. Our Lancaster Mill, like any other manufacturing enterprise, must produce its goods in a way that enables us to sell them at the prices our customers demand while yielding the return that our investors require. If we cannot, over the long term, meet that challenge, our fate is clear. Balance is a founding principle of the United States Constitution, and balance is crafted into every major law and act that flows from it. The Federal Power Act requires that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, define that rates under its jurisdiction are just and reasonable. One would assume that an enlightened self-interest, if not the law itself, would also require FERC to include in its finding of just and reasonable, thank you, some balancing of the needs of generators with the needs of the industrials and other customers. The economic fact of life is that a vibrant economy needs both electricity generators and industrial consumers to be healthy and to be able to maintain their operations into a reasonable future, especially those electricity generators and manufacturing players that engage in stable employment. It's abundantly clear, however, from an example cited by me and others today, that customers, especially industrial customers, operate in what must be a FERC blind spot. Instead of balance, the present market designs clearly encourage the health of electricity generators, and this is done at the expense, if not of the very family-sustaining manufacturing jobs the Commonwealth needs. My recommendations are in my prepared testimony, and I yield to the judge, and I'd be happy to address any questions that you may have. And I do thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Vice Chairman Christie.
Okay. Thank you. And you've painted a fairly disturbing picture here that I hope we're able to provide some type of a forward plan here to try to mitigate them. The Lancaster plan, is that PPNL or MedEd?
It's PPNL.
So that doesn't leave us a lot of time here. The caps are coming off in less than 14 months.
Yes, sir.
I really don't have any other questions. I've heard similar stories from other manufacturers in Pennsylvania, and I think it's a wake-up call. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chairman.
Commissioner Paulson.
David, thank you for being here. I think all of us as a collective body, thank you for your investment here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I spent 14 years in the economic development arena, and I believe you have a plant in my home county of Chester County in Downingtown, Pennsylvania. I think you have an investment there as well. It's staggering to hear you talk about some of the job loss. There's 700 jobs in I believe it was Hagerstown, Maryland, 820 jobs in Rockdale, and obviously we want to retain your investment here in Pennsylvania. And when I look at your company, it's a very well-run company. In fact, in Q2 of this year, you experienced an 80% increase in your net income over the prior year, citing higher prices for our products as the key driver. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're here talking to us about electricity pricing and the profound impact it has on your bottom line, but isn't Alcoa's real issue the worldwide aluminum market? And I share that with you because, you know, we go through a lot of this debate here in Pennsylvania, you know, in taking care of one segment of the industrial base and losing sight of small businesses and residential ratepayers alike. So your thoughts there, again, the company's doing extremely well. We want to see your continued investment here in the Commonwealth. But, you know, carving out another, and maybe my question to you is, What would you like to see in your electricity pricing? Is there a magical number? If the governor's action team was meeting with you this week, you know, in the case of Maryland, I think you guys lobbied the legislature for some rate relief about 5-6 years ago. Your thoughts there?
Well, you're talking about our second quarter. Have you seen the third quarter?
I have not.
Well, that's not as good.
Okay.
With respect to being captive to the worldwide price of aluminum, that's partly true, but our ability to compete depends on how well we convert the bauxite or the aluminum or the alumina, depending on the plant, depending on the state. It depends on our ability to convert that raw material into a usable product better than our many competitors around the world. So. I mean, we're all subject to the same aluminum market, but we compete with each other on the efficiency with which we convert, and electricity is a very large part of that conversion cost. In terms of a target price, I don't have one. But I do know that in order for us to compete against even our own mill in Iowa versus the our own mill in Russia or the other competitor mills we have in West Virginia, Kentucky, and around the world, we're against a hard spot right now.
In the case of your Rockdale, Texas smelting plant that you closed, as I understand it, you were working with TXU Energy. You had an EPA mandate to basically enter into a relationship with them. And as I understand it, you got caught up in some reliability issues with TXU. As a result, that was one of the drivers in your decision to close the plant? Or was it, help me out here and understand that.
That situation is relatively complex. And the factors you mentioned are involved. But the single most important driver that curtailed the production of smelting, that curtailed the smelting operation at Rockdale, was cost. As the electricity to run that smelter was just more than the cost of the market could bear, and that smelting is it was being taken up by other smelters in our system. But more recently, it's just not being replaced at all.
But in the relationship you had with TXU, the excess load, you had access to sell that load back into other customers, I understand. Is that correct?
I personally am not familiar with that particular contract.
Okay.
Appreciate you being here today, and again, I want to reiterate our commitment to helping you grow your business here in the Commonwealth, so thank you.
Commissioner Pitzer-Roy.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I think that Sue Kelly may have deferred to you earlier when I raised the question of the letter that we're in receipt of that was sent to the governor on three different occasions from Pennsylvania Electricity Consumers and Employers. Do you have any views on their position?
Yes, I do. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I've been wearing my ball cap, my Phillies ball cap, most of the last month. And these days I live in Pittsburgh, and somebody asked me what I thought of Major League Baseball in Pittsburgh, and I said I thought it might be a good idea. The kind of competition that the companies that you list in that letter, it's not the kind of Major League competition that we face. There's none of the customers that you listed in that letter are up against a competitor based in Russia or France or Italy or even Washington State or Iowa. Those competitions all happen within the same community. Conversely, if you take a mill of ArcelorMittal or Air Products or Alcoa or any one of the 26 members of IECA, and who really do face competition from India or China or Russia or from Texas or Iowa, and you render that mill uncompetitive and those jobs leave that community, you don't really need to have a Walmart or 7-Eleven anymore, because those Walmarts and 7-Elevens can't sustain the economy of that area. I used to live in Northern Virginia, and one of the fun things I used to do, I already said I like baseball, I used to drive to Frederick, Maryland to go see the Frederick Keys. It's a minor league team for the Baltimore Orioles. And about a third of the right field wall was a great big sign, you know, sponsored by East Alco. The Frederick Alcoa worked there. I haven't been back there in a while, but you know, now that that works or is closed and those 850 jobs are no longer there and that multiplier effect is gone from that community, I mean, I wonder who's filling that void to make that sponsorship of the Frederick Keys. So it's, you know, it's not the same kind of competition. It's a very, it's apples, it's not even apples and oranges, it's watermelons and grapes. So that is my personal opinion about that letter. I mean, they raise a fair point, but it's not the same thing.
Just on page 6 of your testimony, you reference the PUC electric price estimate dated August 14, 2008. I think the good news is you'll see when we post the new price estimates are looking better and they're going down, so you might want to keep your eye on that.
Yeah, I do see that. As a matter of fact, we're seeing that commodity prices for fuel are backed off a lot since August. As a matter of fact, just in the last 6 weeks. Earlier in October, we went to a seminar in New York where it's a worldwide econometric forecast for fuel prices, and one of the interesting things that we learned was that we really shouldn't be made too comfortable by the back off of fuel prices now. What's happened in the economy is a little bit of a back off from the edge. Usually when you have a supply and demand curve in economic theory, they're a nice kind of a lazy X. When we're looking at the data being presented by these people, they were showing us that globally, the global capacity to produce oil is about 86.5 million barrels a day. And that's really it. I mean, that's really as far as you can press it, because the rate of production from the wells that we have is declining. It's hard to produce more oil than that. That's about all the world can produce right now. And with the economy driving globally as hard as it was through the first two quarters of 2008 with China and India and the rest of us, prices were right, the demand was right at that edge, and that's why the prices went from $70 a barrel up to $150 a barrel. Now that China's gone into their post-Olympic fatigue, is what the economists call it, and the general economy has backed off a bit, we've had a corresponding fall in prices. We're now lower with oil prices now than we were last year. But the warning is, don't be complacent about that fuel, those energy costs going down, because the production capacity of the world is still balanced on that same life edge. And if demand picks up again, when we hit that 86.5 million barrel a day wall again, we'll see those same prices again. But for the time being, we'll take the lower prices.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you as well for coming in today, and thank you for your testimony. What I'd like to say for all of us here today, and those who may be viewing by television later, is that this hearing is not an academic exercise. We're not soliciting these testimonies because it's nice to know what's going on academically and theoretically in the wholesale electricity markets. We're very concerned about what's going on for the very fact of what your testimony illustrates, the impact that it could have on Pennsylvania. I can assure you that we will be looking at this carefully, and where there are tweaks that can be made to get prices and competition more in line with where we think they will be, these things will happen. So thank you again for coming.
Commissioner Gardner, thank you very much for your support, and I'll just be happy to, I'll say that we would be happy to support and help in any way that we could.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Charlene, you have failed to tell everyone your most notable qualification. You, like me, you're a graduate of the University of Notre Dame.
Happy to say so, Mr. Chairman. Usually they say that you can always tell the Notre Dame people in the room because they'll tell you.
Well, if you shared that with us right up front, I'm sure everybody would have believed you even more, as of course I do. Thanks for your testimony. You and I know that I've met with you and other Alcoa representatives about these issues before, and I appreciate the fact that you've put it in writing and shared it with my colleagues and the public. So we're not going to let it go without acting on it as well. So I thank you. Thanks for coming.
Mr. Chairman, it's as was said earlier, it's noteworthy that not all the commissions and all the states around in the union are doing this. So it's to your great credit that these hearings are being held. I want to point out that one of the recommendations I make is I advocate that we have a specific FERC advocate empowered, you know, as a matter of legislation, and I point to the example of Ohio, and we talked about that. And I noted that earlier in the hearing with one of the other witnesses, you did point out that within your staff, you were augmenting the numbers and the attorneys in your staff doing these things. It's my personal opinion that a piece of legislation actually creating a FERC advocate position accountable to the commission gives that position some more gravitas and more weight and perhaps some more effectiveness. But if that's not the way that the commission chooses to operate, I'm not going to debate the how or the how with you. I think the important thing is that, as I say, we are in FERC's blind spot, and it's incumbent upon us. I mean, FERC is a big truck, so it's incumbent upon us to blink our lights and honk our horn, do everything we can to make sure the FERC sees us on the road. So, again, anything that you choose to do, we would be supportive of in that area, and I'd be happy to work with you and your staff along those lines.
Thank you very much. And I thank all of the witnesses again and remind everyone that written replies will be submitted to the Commission by November 17th, and that we will continue with the same subject at another hearing on December 18th. With that, Judge Koshiris, I think we're done for the day.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, Mr. Shalom. It was nice meeting you, and whatever advantage there was in being last, you had it. Goodbye.
Lucky me.